Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand. Two masters of the trade, conversation hot, you need a fan. It's Legal Face Off, so step into the ring. No topic off limit, cause they gon' cover everything. Now check them out on Facebook and Twitter. Like and follow, because we don't wanna miss ya. Introducing your host, Christina and Rich. Legal Face Off is about to begin, yeah. Welcome to Legal Face Off.
And we welcome you into Legal Face Off on WGN, WGNRadio.com. The last episode of August, and per usual, plenty to get to. We'll talk about a couple guys who are in the 36 Under 36 Award. We'll talk about some hate speech, the legal grab bag at the end, and there's some swag, some LFO swag. I was punched in the face with the LFO swag, and we'll talk about that. But first, to lead off the show, we bring in David Green, who's the Civil Liberties Director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He's going to lay out the law on some hate speech. Hello, David. Welcome to LFO.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So obviously the news is the right to express your opinion, given the events in Charlottesville, in Boston. What are your thoughts on these events recently as they relate to freedom of expression?
Yeah, well, you know, whenever you see speech that I think most people can agree is highly, highly disturbing and offensive, it's a test of our First Amendment values. But it's really well established under our legal system that even that horrible, disgusting speech is constitutionally protected, and that is the case here. We do need to distinguish, you know, the speech from any acts of violence that might have occurred. We can separate the violent acts from the speech, but hate speech itself isn't even a legally defined term, and we certainly, under our legal system, actually protect it the same way we would protect any other speech.
So, David, what could have been done differently with respect to Charlottesville? I mean, obviously, the First Amendment is what it is, and hate speech is protected. What could have been done differently so that maybe Charlottesville wouldn't have been as tragic as it was?
Yeah, well, you know, I wasn't there, so it's a little hard to say. In similar cases, what we would tell people is there should be adequate law enforcement if they can anticipate that this will move from just speech to something else. What we saw in Charlottesville was a horrible tragedy, the death of by a very, you know, sick and disturbed person who certainly went far beyond what their constitutional protections were in terms of ramming the car into the crowd.
So the Supreme Court has dealt, you know, as recently as this past June with speech that demeans on the basis of race, ethnicity, gender, religion, etc. How do you distinguish between protected speech and, another speech? Is that something that the court should be doing? Is that something the legislature would be doing? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, what the First Amendment tells is that we don't make that distinction in most cases. I mean, the default is that speech is protected, and that default applies to hateful speech. We do have some exceptions in the law for certain protected environments, where people might have some ability to shield themselves from harassing speech, so schools and places of employment and things like that. Generally, we don't need to make that distinction.
What are your thoughts on companies like GoDaddy, Google, Airbnb, Uber, who have stepped forth in the wake of Charlottesville and denied access to their different sites to people that they have decided should not avail themselves of that technology?
Well, my first emotional thought was, wow, this is great. Now, you know, these places won't actually have an outlet. They're sort of being voted on by the public, and we don't want to hear their speech. But, you know, after I get over that emotional response, I actually get very concerned, because although I don't see the same legal problems with it, I don't like to see our internet intermediaries actually just removing content without certain systems in place. And I do think that's what we saw here.
What do you see as the future, at least based on what we've experienced as of late with Charlottesville? What do you anticipate will happen in the coming days and weeks in the wake of that?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I mean, it seems like what we're seeing now are more are more protests and counter-protests. This is a lot of sort of free speech principles in action. I don't know how much further that will continue. What I hope to see from the companies, though, is really adopting some type of procedures for accountability and transparency and due process and when they remove content. That's what I'd really like to see. But we've been pushing for them to adopt those procedures for a long time, and they've been very resistant so far.
How have you been? Tell us more about how you've been pushing that.
Yeah, I mean, if people are interested, they can search for information about the Manila Principles, which is a set of principles about transparency and accountability and due process about what that we want internet intermediaries to sign on to and adopt. And these are things that they will pledge to follow these procedures before they remove content, so that people whose content is removed, if there's a complaint, they won't just remove things. They'll actually investigate. They will give the people who've created the content the opportunity to explain their content, to challenge any decisions that are made. Their criteria will be transparent and published beforehand. And because what we've seen prior is a lot of really bad decisions that, even if you liked this decision, we've seen a lot of really bad decisions by companies, especially when they get a complaint from sort of a powerful interest like Shell Oil or Microsoft or De Beers Diamonds. These are all examples of companies that have pressured ISPs and domain name services to remove content.
Last question on Legal Face-Off, and we'll let you go. I know that you were a founding member with David Sobel and Sherry Steele of the Internet Free Expression Alliance. You're currently on the Northern California Society for Professional Journalists Freedom of Information Committee. Is it your feeling that the free market of ideas is almost self-regulatory, that you don't need entities to step in and silence speech that they find offensive, that the free market will do that on its own?
I don't know if I'd go all the way and say I'm completely free market, but I do tend to go that way. I think there probably are some situations, and net neutrality, for example, I think is a good example of this, where a certain amount of market regulation is appropriate. And again, I'm not advocating for no regulation. What I would like to see is, as I said, as a system of processes. I think some might interpret that as being some type of market playing around in the market, not letting it work out the issues itself.
That's David Green. He is the Civil Liberties Director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We appreciate your time here in Chicago. Thank you.
Thank you.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Facebook, we're on Twitter. Always you can subscribe on iTunes, Legal Face-Off. Search for Legal Face-Off WGN. In the studio with us now, Mark Karlinski, who's the editor of the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks for coming in, Mark. So tell us about your evolution to editor of the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. How'd you get there, and how long have you been on the job?
Sure. Well, I've been with the paper since early 2013, and it's actually been quite a quick rise. I actually started back in 2013 as an intern for the paper down at its Springfield Bureau through a master's program at the University of Illinois Springfield. I worked there for a little bit, I would say closer to 6 months, covering the Illinois legislative session that year, which seems a little bit more functional than now. I thought at the time it was utter chaos and great training to come
whole
back
different era now
to the big city, and by September I was named a staff writer for the paper. I was covering the Daily Center beat, so things that you'll read in the daily paper covering lawsuits out of the law division, chancery division, multi-million dollar litigation, administration of the courts, the chief judge's office, the circuit court clerk's office, all of those things, primarily in the civil aspect of the court, which is one of the largest, if not the largest, unified court systems in the country. So there's a whole lot to go on within politics, within business. We have a readership of lawyers in the city that really need that information to know who's getting business, if there's people that need referrals, who's winning, who's losing, and exactly what aspects of their case are making them winners or might need them to go back to the drawing board.
What is the current readership? Any idea?
I don't have the exact numbers. I know it's several thousand,
yeah.
But you'll find within, particularly within the trial bar, you'll find most attorneys who do injury law, family law, anything like that, make a point of reading it. And there are still firms in the city who have annual meetings. When our paper hits the press in River North every day right around 3 o'clock, it's delivered somewhere between 3 and 4, and there are firms that line up in the managing partner's office to read through the headlines, to cut clips, to figure out what happened.
To make sure you're not in the headline. Also, sometimes, make sure you're not in that ARDC section.
Exactly.
That's one of my favorite sections, by the way, to seeing what people have done wrong and how to avoid getting in trouble.
Exactly. We look at that as something that it's a proactive tool for everyone else to avoid making that. But generally, I think when you make a law bulletin headline, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
We've heard anecdotes from attorneys that they can't make it out of their elevator unscathed within, if they leave by 4:30 and their photo is there with their $6 million personal injury settlement, word gets around quick. So we really do embrace the fact that we are the paper of a pretty close-knit and well-connected community. It's a little bit surreal that it's a community, even though we're in a city of 3 million people, but we really do try and cater to that specific audience differently than what you might find at the bigger papers. Although we fully intend and do regularly try and succeed in getting ahead of them on legal stories, we really like to take ownership over beats like the Illinois Appellate Court, Illinois Supreme Court, and stuff within lawsuits at the Daly Center and federal court, and provide that with a lens that you can't necessarily get when you don't have a readership that, for the most part, all have law degrees.
So the Law Bulletin is, I've had the fine privilege of working with you, Mark, and with your publication now for a number of years, and it's obviously Chicago Lawyer Magazine is affiliated with the Law Bulletin.
Come on, give a better plug than that. Inside Out column.
Inside Out with Sussler.
There you go.
We've been...
We've cut his first name out. He's like, Cher, no. Just Sussler.
He's like, Tigga.
Yeah,
Drake.
The artist formerly known as David Sussler.
Madonna, you know? It's a company.
S-U-S.
So, and we've actually had the fine privilege of working with the publication now since April of 2010. So we've had quite a run with the Chicago Lawyer Magazine, and we love working with you all. So the Law Bulletin's been around, I think, since 1854. Is that right?
That's right, 1854. It's now the second oldest news publication in the city that's still standing. And when you figure that the city itself wasn't founded until, I believe, 1837, truly, when this came out and became the go-to publication for lawyers, there weren't that many lawyers. There wasn't much of a city here. And it's really grown along with the courts, with the evolution mm-hmm. of the courts from the early history of the state.
So when you look at that amazing history and you look at where media is today, you look at where the legal profession is today, what do you think are the biggest challenges that you as the editor have and that your publication has with the environment that we're in now?
I think the environment that we face in legal media is similar to the one that you find broader. It's that we have to cut through more noise than ever. It's a wonderful thing with the rise of the internet that everyone can get onto a platform, whether it's writing a blog or through social media or through any other means to communicate with the public. But what it also means is that there's an added premium for people who do journalism to really sift through all that information coming at you and get really to what the heart of it is, what's important, what's valuable. Anyone who's in law knows that your time is precious, and wasted time is often wasted money or money that could have been billed elsewhere. So we really think that we're providing a service and that we spend our days with our staff going through the day's headlines and picking out stuff that is valuable to you, but also interesting. You know, a lot of it is not necessarily the hard-hitting news. We like to cover features of people doing interesting things, awards they're winning, and sort of just keep you in tune with the community that lawyers work in.
Mark, you have your pulse on the Chicago legal community you know, pretty much like no one else. We're going to talk in a moment in the legal grab bag about the decrease in law school applications. That's certainly one trend. Is there any other trends that you can share with our listeners about the local legal community?
I think the one that you've that's been covered fairly extensively over the last few years, and is, in my observation, and I obviously don't have a full grasp of it, but the mergers and acquisitions of what are, were long-standing Chicago firms, that process is largely, it seems like, a little bit completed, but you have a lot of these firms that were in Chicago with Chicago lawyers' names on the door for decades and decades who now are still operating. They still have autonomy here, but just the economics of things and the way that law doesn't necessarily fit in one city. If you're a multinational company or even just a multi-state company, you want someone who might be in New York or might be in Kansas City or might be anywhere else. And so that's a big factor. And then the other factor that sort of is touching on that same thing with the law schools is the great millennial question. And I am one, so I think it's been an interesting it's been an interesting thing to sort of
all
cover.
Us old people like to yell at the millennials.
Exactly. So
get off my lawn.
I try and avoid that in our coverage, considering that I'm the same age at 27 as my peers who are through law school are now mostly in their first year or two or three at firms. So I think I have an interesting lens on that, being the editor for the paper, but also going home and in my social life talking with people who are still very low on the ladder and climbing. But I think the other aspect is how law firms now, their leadership, particularly at bigger firms, are trying to cater and draw younger talent who might not be drawn to the same things that people were a few decades ago. Generally speaking, and obviously we don't want to do too sweeping of millennials after I just said that, but there's an idea that people aren't as drawn to big, flashy offices. They want amenities. They want things that are going to be catering to flexibility with where they can work. They want to work remotely. They might like having some more features at the office, an exercise room. They might like different transit options that they're living in the city and maybe not in the suburbs. So stuff like that that firms are going to do to differentiate themselves, embrace diversity,
and they've
show
never
awareness.
Seen they've never seen In Living Color.
That's
or
true.
A beeper.
I've
do you know
seen,
what a beeper is?
I think I have seen a beeper, somewhere. But I was probably in first or second grade.
Have you seen an 8-track player?
No.
I don't think
no
I
way.
Have. I was barely there for cassettes.
I have two questions about the Capitol. You spent some time there, obviously.
Sure.
Springfield is kind of like the Wild West now. Was there a big lesson that you took from your time in Springfield dealing with all the politics and all the whirlwinds down there in Springfield?
Yeah, I think that one of the takeaways I try and have that keeps me less cynical is that, for the most part, the people down there face a very, very difficult situation. I tend to give most of the leaders down there, including the ones who have attack ads against them, the benefit of the doubt that the reason that things are stuck the way they are and have enormous painful gridlock is because there are factors in there that make it. That's not an outright excuse as to why they can't make hard decisions and get things done despite what might be political pain. But generally, I think that a lot of them go in and take the job seriously. And the other aspect is a little bit more on the cynical side. It's that when you're covering things there, you always want to err on the side of assuming that the bill won't go through committee today. They won't have the hearing today. It won't pass today, just because things kind of work on their own pace down there. There's even before there was a budget crisis, I didn't really get a sense that there was a ton of urgency in how things worked. Maybe they'll have learned a lesson, but I wouldn't count on that.
That's Mark Karlinski, editor of the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin, chicagolawbulletin.com. And I've been handed a note from Rich. What is this?
Don't forget it's 36 under 36 award.
Oh, right, that's right.
Just
yeah,
like
36
our,
under 36.
Prior guest.
Well, we...
double high.
The double high. Yeah, is that a real thing, the double high?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so
yes.
A little background on that. High is the Hebrew word for life. It's made with two letters, and those letters in Hebrew numerology equate to the number 18. And so you'll often hear when things are life is sort of a signified number, it's multiples of 18. When you give a friend a bar mitzvah check, you might give him 18. If you really like that friend, you'd give him 36. And so the idea behind double chai was that they would give it to 36 people under the age of 36.
Yeah, my bar mitzvah, we had to it's always a challenge to figure out the multiple of 18 that, a larger check was in. Like after 36, it's all bells and whistles to me. But very impressive award. I can't believe you're 27. I mean, that's really impressive. We really thank you for joining us. And the Law Bulletin, is a must read. I mean, it's, I'm the guy at my firm.
It's a terrific publication.
I'm the one who takes it home every night because I really want to spend some time with it and read it. So I'm a cover.
I can't read Rich's Scritch Scratch. Yeah. So I, you know,
it clearly says
it looks like a three, and then it looks like an arrow, and then a W, and then okay, it's fine. Thanks for stopping by. Congrats on the award. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN and WGNRadio.com. Joining us in the studio, Elliot Rebin, who's a staff attorney for the Office of the Chief Judge. And I just learned, I always find these things fascinating. You used to work with Rich at Bryce Downey and Lenkoff. Welcome into the studio.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And he still talks to me, unbelievably enough. Still didn't come here under subpoena or duress. But yeah, Elliot, thanks for joining us. Lots to talk about. You've got a very interesting career path so far. Lots to come in the future. But tell us about the most recent accomplishment was the 36 Under 36 Award that you were recently named to. Tell us about
it
that.
It was a real nice honor from the JUF, Jewish United Federation. They call it double chai in the chai.
I love
and
that.
And chai is 18, which is representative of life. And
yeah,
they doubled
Mark
it to 36, so it's 36 under 36. So yeah. I was one of those nominated
one more time,
people.
Double
chai.
Chai.
You want me to build
see,
as
a fellow,
phlegm
as a fellow Jewish man, you have to use a lot of phlegm when you're using it. Picture yourself
it's nice
like
that you have a spit bucket right
yeah.
here.
Picture you're like an 82-year-old guy at a deli eating a nice piece of whitefish, and then you got to go, chai.
Or a cat with a hairball.
Yeah. We've also got Mark Karlinski coming on in a second, who's
also
the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin editor. Also a double high.
I think very highly of him.
Yeah. I'm trying to make the 50 under 50 award here at some point. But
the triple high.
Yeah. So, Elliot, you work for the chief judge right now in the Circuit Court of Cook County. But you've got a lot of other things going on besides that. You're also adapting a book or adapted a book into a screenplay. Tell us about that.
A book based on a true story. The book is called In the Shadow of Freedom, and it really inspired me a number of years ago. And I know the co-writer of it, who I reached out to because I was so moved by the story, I thought it should be shared with more people.
What's it about?
It's about a Congolese immigrant who was born poor in Brazzaville in the Congo, and was forced to be a child soldier. He was able to escape with the help of his father to America, where he was recruited to be a Marine. And he joined the Marines and ended up serving several tours in Iraq and participated in the mission to rescue Private Jessica Lynch. And then returned to the United States, still not a citizen, at which point he was sworn in as a citizen after serving in the military. He decided to go back to his home, to the Congo, to help his family. And when he got there, he was arrested, imprisoned, and tortured. So this is the story of how he handled that, how he was able to, spoiler alert, escape and return to the United States.
And you wrote the screenplay?
I did write the screenplay.
Yeah, how'd you get into that from being a lawyer?
Well, going back to 1999, I worked for a brief period at Morgan Freeman's film production company, Revelation Entertainment, as an intern. And it was while I was in college, so I had at that time read a lot of screenplays to understand what was good, what was bad. I was one of the people there that would get the first look at a bunch of screenplays that were submitted, and out of hundreds of screenplays, there might be two or three that were worth considering being made. So I worked on that and had the aspirations at the time to be a screenwriter, but didn't write a screenplay. Thought maybe one day I would if I had the opportunity. So I went back to college. I did get offered a position to work there, but I elected to finish my bachelor's degree and went on to a totally different track to become a lawyer. Went on to proudly work for Rich's firm, and now that I had a little more free time, having left private practice, I was able to focus on my
definitely no
passion.
Free time in my head. Zero.
No, it would have been very difficult, if not impossible, to write a screenplay while working for Rich. And it's, you know, a million miles a minute there. Well,
but well, yet there's more to
your
story.
Yeah, well, I would love to hear a little bit more about what it's like to work for Rich, but I'm
no,
just...
That's
I
a
have
whole,
the inside
no.
story.
He's like, I don't want this on
waivers. Hey, look, we're out of time.
There's court orders, there's releases. It's a whole complicated...
I'll say he lawyers like he plays in the basketball court. He doesn't mind throwing a few elbows.
Okay.
But he's
Sam knows the answer to that.
But he's the zealous.
In other words, I miss a lot and I'm really slow.
But you zealously represent your clients.
Yes.
So.
He's very zealous.
He's got a high motor.
One more thing before we let you go. Two more things notable about your legal career is that you were on the PBS show Check Please. You were one of the restaurant reviewers on Check Please. And you also were part of the defense team on both of Lee Blagojevich trials. You were the youngest member of the team, right, on both trials? No?
Just go with it.
Yes, I was the youngest. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the I point is, I disclosed my age. Well, the point is,
I am under 36.
It was pretty early in your legal career, right. And you were on both trials, and still
that's right.
maintain a relationship with the former governor a little bit, I know. So at this point in your career, you've accomplished a lot, Elliot. Very impressive, and continue to fill us in on what's going on.
Thank you, Rich, and thanks for your help.
Absolutely.
Having worked at your firm was a great experience that yes. I take with me in the future.
Made
me a tougher
us.
Lawyer. I'll
That's
say
right.
that.
Thanks, Elliot.
All right, thanks, guys. Thanks, Tim.
Before we get to the legal grab bag on Legal Face-Off, we have to talk about the memorabilia, I guess, the gear we have.
Swag time on
Swag
Legal
time.
Face-Off.
Tina, the
Do we
pen.
Have a swag time theme song?
Well, Tina gave me a pen and then said I have to take it back because yeah. it's not yours. There's a boxing glove on top, and there's a button that releases the glove. It's kind of mm-hmm. like sock 'em boppers.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you want to aim carefully. At your adversary.
Don't take it easy.
There is so much.
I have a lawyer literally right here.
Yes.
We're very combative people
That's
here
right.
on Legal Face
right.
Off.
That Gotta is keep... a nice looking pen. I like that.
Set back the Legal Face Off marketing budget.
About $250.
A lot of money, but well worth it.
Rich and Tina both did tell me, though, after the show, we have a meeting about the future of the show.
Yes.
So the pens may have limited my ability to be a part of this. We've got eight topics on the grab bag. Let's start with you, Rich.
Wait, that was supposed to be a surprise. You stepped all over the lead. We have a couple of surprises at the end, timely ones. So you'll hear about them. Though.
Okay, all right. Back where I was going.
Yes.
The rally lawsuit in Charlottesville.
So, yeah, Charlottesville, obviously, in the news the last couple of weeks, including involving our president talking about it. So now in the wake of the rally, two sisters who claimed they were injured in their vehicle when the car plowed into the group of protesters have now filed a lawsuit. This will be one of many we will see, inevitably. These two sisters have filed a $3 million lawsuit, and they have named two individuals in state court, including the driver. They've also, very notably, named the organizer of the rally, Jason Kessler, who's been in the news, and Richard Spencer, who is one of the white nationalists who has been involved in this rally, and also three dozen other groups. They say that they were driving, and they were stopped at a crosswalk when the car ran into theirs, and they're claiming some unnamed damages at this point. So we will continue to see lawsuits resulting from rallies like this. We have not yet seen one in the Heather Heyer situation. Of course, she was the young lady who was killed, but I would imagine her family, her mother was one of the speakers at the rally. I imagine they would file a lawsuit at some point here, too.
Johnson & Johnson is ordered to pay $417 million in a talcum powder case.
Yeah, just yesterday, the jury in California awarded the $417 million, which, you know, even in the verdicts that we see regularly, jumps right off the page given the amount. They awarded it against Johnson & Johnson, as you mentioned. The verdict broke down in $70 million in compensatory damages and $347 million in punitive damages. So for our listeners, let's break that down because, you know, you often hear those terms. Maybe not everyone understands what those two terms are. The $70 million is the smaller figure in this case. That's compensatory damages. That is usually, as the name implies, meant to compensate someone for their losses. And those usually go to compensate actual damages. So things like medical bills, lost wages, loss of or pain and suffering, loss of normal life. The biggest part of the verdict
was punitive,
right. And as the name implies, no great breaking news, is that is meant to punish the defendant. In this case, the jury felt that because Johnson & Johnson was aware, according to some evidence brought forth in the trial, aware for decades of the potential danger involving talcum powder when used in this way by women, they felt that it was appropriate to punish them. And not just punish them in this case, but the idea behind punitive damages is to send a message to other companies. That's why the award is so high. We've seen similar awards in other cases like this. Johnson & Johnson has already announced that they will appeal. Notably, there is no definitive study that links ovarian cancer to talcum or baby powder. Several studies, in fact, question the relationship there. So they will appeal. But right now, this verdict against Johnson & Johnson just came out yesterday.
Did you see what Eva Echevarria said, that if there was a warning label on the product, she would have stopped using it? But then it says the company has no obligation to put a label on it.
Yeah. Because talcum powder is considered legally a cosmetic, they don't have to undergo the same kind of review by the FDA as other products like a drug would. So that's why they don't have a legal duty to put a label on it. It would have to be properly labeled with the ingredients and other information. But yeah, you're right that legally this company did not have an obligation to put a warning label on it. Other countries, though, and other products actually do carry that kind of warning, just, I think, to avoid this kind of verdict. You know, they're going above what the law requires.
On to the next one. A judge will not guarantee payment for our buddy El Chapo's private lawyer. El Chapo back on Legal Face Off.
El Chapo, one of our favorites.
It's been a while.
He still hasn't made it into the studio.
No.
Live for some reason.
I should also say he's not our buddy.
Well, he hasn't dug a tunnel to get over to the studio.
Yeah, that's right. But El Chapo is, of course, the now deposed drug lord that was captured by authorities several months ago. He is now represented by public defenders, but he wants his private attorney, a man named Jeffrey Lichtman, to take over. Unfortunately for him, El Chapo, his assets are frozen. Funny how that works, that when you're arrested, the federal government doesn't allow you access the billions of dollars you've gained in the drug trade over the years. But he wants U.S. District Court Judge Brian Kogan to allow him to access his funds to hire this high-priced lawyer. This hearing took place last week, and the judge said that he would not pressure the government to keep its hands off the cash. He'll be allowed at least to discuss hiring this lawyer. The judge said, "This is still America. The man deserves not only his choice of counsel, but also a fair trial." So all kidding aside, the legal theory here is that you are allowed to be represented by someone that you choose. You don't have to be represented by a public defender. Of course, you have to be able to afford them. And there's this discussion about whether you should be allowed to access that money.
Well, maybe one of his family members can chip in and give him a loan.
Yeah, for sure. One more thing with the lawyer. He's very notable in that he has represented other people, including John Gotti. John Gotti Jr., who was the son of the mob boss. He said that these security arrangements dealing with El Chapo were the most stringent he's seen in 27 years. He said that when you walk into the courthouse, there's helicopters buzzing around. So we'll see what develops, and we'll see if El Chapo gets to hire his own lawyer.
Moving on. Online dating. All right. Match.com. Who's got a Match.com profile? Hands in the air. No hands in the air. A fired lawyer who has set up a fake Match.com profile of a female attorney has been cited by a disciplinary board.
Yes, so you can't make this stuff up, and we like to feature this on Legal Face Off. So on August 4, Drew Quitchow, who is now a former partner in the law firm of Thompson & Weintraub in Bloomington, was cited by the ARDC after he admitted to setting up a fake online profile through Match.com of a female lawyer also from Bloomington. He posted a false review of her in a database of legal professionals and also registered her to receive information from the Obesity Action Coalition, as well as about, you know, information about pork production and from an organization about diabetics. So scrolling back to how this story developed, apparently the Match.com profile made a number of claims about this Jane Doe, including her marital status, age, the fact that she's a smoker, as well as her favorite places to hang out. Last December, Match.com provided the IP address for the fake profile, and in January, Drew Quichow's firm confirmed that the profile had been created from a firm computer. In February, it was confirmed that it was his computer. And when he was approached by the firm about this, he was immediately terminated after he admitted to the wrongdoing.
And so this is not the same attorney who filed a stalking order against him, or is it?
I don't think it is. I think this is another person.
Yeah, yes. So this guy also had opposing counsel in a case, and she filed in February an emergency stalking, no contact order against him, which she later agreed to dismiss. But not a great track record.
So wait, I'm clearly the dumbest person in the room. Is there a real person on this profile or not? I'm so confused here.
I think there is she is a real person, and I think for confidentiality reasons, they're identifying her as Jane Doe.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. See, you guys need to explain these things to me. So this is somebody set up a profile about a woman whose real name is obviously not Jane Doe.
Right.
And is acting to be this person. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Gotcha. So
yes.
You can't do that.
No. Apparently it's not a really good idea, especially when the person's identifiable.
Yeah.
I see John and Jane Doe and I just get lost.
You're like, why are these people all over the news always?
Who cares about Jane Doe?
How would you like it if your name was really Jane Doe, though, and you
right.
had to deal with
all the Jane Does listening right now?
Character assassination
so upset.
Constantly.
Law school applications. We've talked about this all the time. We've talked about it for years on Legal Face Off. The drop in law school applications, and Tina, that appears to still be an issue.
Yes. So the U.S. News and World Report came out on August 8 and confirmed what we already have known to be the case for a while, which is that the number of law school applications continues to drop precipitously. Given the soft demand in the profession, we can't say that we're terribly surprised by this. The upside appears to be less competition for scholarships and financial aid, as well as less competition in law school classes to do well. But there were some pretty startling statistics that were shared by U.S. News and World Report, including the fact that since 2010, the average first-year class size has dropped by 31% after it had been rising for almost 40 years. And from 2008 to 2016, the number of applicants at the higher-ranked schools dropped by over 20% and by over 50% at lower-ranked schools. And during that same time period, acceptance rates at the top 14 schools increased slightly, but increased by more than 20% at the lower ranked schools. So the takeaway is that, among other things, pundits believe that we're going to see more law school closings than have already happened. And fewer people appear to be using law school as a fallback.
Well, good. I mean, isn't the short answer good?
It's a great way to filter out the, I mean, do the losers.
We've covered this topic a lot on our show, had lots of different perspectives, including from some local law school deans. But the short answer is good. I mean, the world doesn't need more lawyers. There's certainly not enough work to go around for the existing lawyers, let alone adding, 5,000 in Illinois a year, 50,000 nationwide kind of thing. So I think people realize that the market is soft and that there's not as much job opportunities for graduates. You know, they could certainly pursue other careers once they have their law degree, but, you know, I think that it's the reality of the world, and we've covered this, you know, recently in terms of more work going to inside counsel. So I think, you know, it's maybe unfortunate for the law schools because they're a business and they need to turn a profit, but for the overall world, I think it's probably a good thing.
Do you two see a lack of interest in your firms, though? Because even though there's a lack of applications, I imagine your firms are still very, you know, popular as far as people applying for
us. If only we had a national hiring partner for a big law firm. Oh, wait a second.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, are the numbers down for you?
Well, we actually, I think, are seeing an uptick in terms of what the size of our classes are. But, you know, you've got to realize that from 2008 until pretty recently, we were pretty flat, like a lot of firms were. And so I think the fight for really strong talent, though, continues, notwithstanding the fact that there's been a drop in applicants. And what I find interesting
and
also—
starting salary just went up, right?
Starting salary just
by
went
what,
up a 10, few months ago 10, by 20,000.
20,000.
What is the starting 20,000. Salary? What is it? It's how
get
much?
Ready for this.
180.
For the starting salary for
a,
what?
In
a first-year Chicago associate.
It's 180,000.
No experience practicing law.
I have to go. I've, you know what? I'm going to law school. Craig, we're going to law school.
What's the number for New York? It's 210?
I think so. I don't know that number off the top of my head. I'm sorry to say.
But 180.
It's a little bit bigger.
Sam, there's still time.
We need Legal Face Off to go once a day.
After hosting this show for 3 years, you're already far more advanced than most people like Tina is seeing. So.
Well, I don't know who John and Jane Doe are, so I don't. Don't go too far. Let's move to the rap game. Drake and Future, both of them are rappers. They've been accused of negligent hiring in a $25 million lawsuit from a concert goer.
Yes. So
didn't we just cover this last time?
I didn't think so.
No, that was someone else.
I think you're thinking
rapper.
Of Gwen Stefani,
oh, that was Gwen Stefani
and the trampling case.
Man. Mm.
Yeah, I was going to say, we've got a lot of musicians who are really getting hammered lately in these lawsuits. So rappers Drake and Future are among a group of defendants involved in a $25 million lawsuit alleging negligence in the hiring of a security guard that worked a concert in Nashville during their Summer 16 tour. The plaintiff claims that the security guard approached her during the concert and asked her to come backstage to meet the performers. When she agreed to go with him, instead of being taken back to meet the rappers, she claims she was thrown to the ground, assaulted, and raped.
Jeez.
It's awful. The security guard, Levy Johnson, was arrested and now awaits trial. And apparently he had an outstanding warrant for assault at the time of the attack. She is claiming that the arena touring companies, the security company, as well as Drake and Future have all displayed negligence through this incident. So it's yet another one of these cases where we're seeing musicians and famous folks involved in lawsuits with fans. And, you know, Taylor Swift, it was the other way around. We had Taylor Swift who said that she was groped backstage by a DJ. So, and she just won her dollar in court, literally. So.
Yeah, notable in this case is not, this is a civil case, but one of the defendants was actually arrested. Levy Johnson.
Levy Johnson the
was
guard,
actually,
the
yeah, he, was,
guard.
He was arrested and he's awaiting trial. So that certainly adds a lot of support to the civil claim.
Let's move to celebrity baby daddy drama. 2 months after Rob Kardashian and Blac Chyna went on that very, very explosive social media rampage, they're back in the news. Looks like a custody battle over their baby daughter, whose name is Dream.
Yes. So People Magazine.
Good names, by the way. We just talked about Future. Now we've got Dream and Blac Chyna.
Blac Chyna is spelled B-L-A-C, by the way.
By the way, you got to say it. I like when you say China, but say it in the Trump voice. China. I got to deal with China.
Blac Chyna.
China.
Blac Chyna and
China
Rob
is evil.
Kardashian.
So People Magazine recently reported that Rob and Blac Chyna, or China.
China.
Are
oh,
do-
China.
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 China. Are duking out custody involving their daughter, Dream. But apparently Page Six reported yesterday that this didn't happen, according to China's attorney. The former couple still have a hearing scheduled on September 18 to address possibly extending the restraining order that China still has against Rob, particularly to address his social media attacks, which involved a number of extremely graphic and expletive-ridden posts.
There were naked photos, too.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys saw.
Well, she sent those. Apparently, she sent those to him saying, you know, she was with this guy around the 4th of July, and that set him off on a social media rampage.
By the way, China also has another son with another prominent person.
These kids are going to be so screwed up.
Can you guess the name of the other kid?
So Nightmare?
I like good. That. That's good.
That's King Cairo.
King Cairo. You got to like the capital of Egypt, Cairo?
Yeah. You got to ball to name your kid King And then her baby daddy is, or King Cairo's dad is Tyga.
King Cairo. No, Tyga. T-Y-G-A, Tyga.
Is it Tyga?
Tyga.
It's Tyga.
God, I am the
And you're making
I'm
fun of me.
I'm the whitest man alive,
and
aren't
you're
I?
Saying that I had a problem saying Jarul.
Tyga. Hey, wait, wait a second. It's T-Y-G-A.
It's Tyga.
It's Tyga.
Tyga. Come on, L.L. Lenkov.
All right, we're coming to the top of the hour on a hump day Wednesday. We've got Tyga coming in. We've got
Tyga.
King Cairo with a number one hit coming to the top.
I believe it's Tyga. I could be wrong. I'm usually
favorite
wrong.
Favorite Tyga song?
Oh, God.
Favorite Dream song?
Well, Dream's future? Only a couple years old.
All right, favorite Drake song. That's easy. As a fellow Canadian, this should be easy for me, but I literally have no idea.
None come
I
to mind.
I ain't got anything.
All right.
Well, I ain't got anything. There's a fitting response.
Bonus time.
Yeah, bonus time.
Bitty,
I did
bitty,
clips.
Bitty, 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 bitty.
I saw a video of all the Bryce, Donnie, and Lenkov employees leaving the building to watch the stupid eclipse.
I'm glad colossal to see that you guys all got an eight billable hours in
so
Lancaster.
Much billable time lost yesterday.
You couldn't even see it. It was cloudy.
You should have been at 444 Westlake. You could see it between the buildings.
It was the biggest hoax since Y2K, in my opinion. But yeah, the legal angle, because you know that's what we got to cover on Legal Face Off. A couple things. So there was some discussion about whether people who were using glasses should be filling out waivers. There's also some discussion about whether if you did, in fact, look at the eclipse like our president did on the balcony, whether that could lead to a workers' compensation claim. You know, I think a lot of companies, and I saw a couple of memos from companies saying this is not mandatory. You don't have to come out and look at the sun just for that reason. There was also, you know, there's also some waivers that by, you know, as ridiculous as the sound, that there were some waivers about by accepting these glasses, we don't accept liability. There's also a judge who denied a witness the chance to look at the eclipse. Judge Stephen Merriday of the Middle District of Florida denied this inmate the chance to go see the eclipse. I mean, what is the world coming to when, you know, merely being behind bars prevents you from totality?
I thought it was a witness.
Or was it a witness?
It was a witness. It was actually
it was
a witness. It was an agent, I think, with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, who apparently had bought a ticket in advance to go follow the totality.
And the order, he quoted Carly Simon.
You're so
in
vain.
In the order, so.
I thought, oh,
never
it
thought
was great
would,
language.
Yeah, never thought we would mix up Carly Simon and the eclipse, but there we did.
Let me be the resident Scrooge here. Yeah. I watched it on television. I thought it was more fitting on television because you couldn't see it where I was at the time. You couldn't even see it because of the clouds. I don't know. I didn't get whipped up. And then I did notice every channel I changed, all the meteorologists were crying.
Yeah, WGN's very own Tom Skilling.
Famous meme now.
He wasn't the only one. They were all crying. I don't know. I don't know that I could ever get to that level for science.
I think it was
picture
a lot
like
more
the Super Bowl times the World Series.
No, I still wouldn't cry. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I'm.
It
a
was
curmudgeon.
A very different experience in Carbondale, though. Like it got super dark because they were in the path of totality. So it was a very different experience. I mean, it got really dark. Apparently.
Well, all I have to say to end off the discussion is, once upon a time I was falling in love, and now I'm only falling apart.
Total eclipse of the heart, baby.
Right.
I don't know how else to end this show with a line like that. Did I miss anything? You said I buried the lead earlier.
That
anything
was it.
We have
the
to
surprise.
Get to? Oh, just the eighth topic. Oh, usually we do seven, but we had an extra finger today. Thank you to our guests. Thanks to Craig Collins. Thanks to Rich. Thanks to Tina. My name is Sam. For anything you may have missed, check us out on Facebook. We're also on Twitter and subscribe on iTunes. The show is Legal Face Off. It's on WGN Radio and WGNRadio.com. And we will see you next time on LFO.